Have your attention, please. I'd like to call to order the January 3rd meeting of the Planning and Development Committee of Council. And just to start with public comment, if you want to speak during the public comment period, that's fine. If you want to speak before the specific issue that comes up, that's fine as well. But please don't waive from the gallery, because I'm not going to recognize you. You know, we have times where everyone can speak, so let's be respectful of everybody's time. And Mr. Brimmer is in traffic up by Long Point Road, so he will be here as soon as he can. So the first order of business is approval of minutes from December 3rd meeting.
Move for approval of the minutes.
We have a motion and a second for approval of minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, minutes are approved. Now, is there anyone who would like to speak now in general comment time, or do you want to wait? Does anyone want to speak now? If not, we'll move on. Okay, we'll move on then. And when we get to a topic, if you would, just let me know you want to speak, and we'll give you that opportunity right before it. Okay, next order of business is review of the Planning Commission's recommendations from the December 19th
meeting.
Meeting, yes.
Good morning, and Happy New Year. This item is the only item that comes to you from the Planning Commission at their meeting last month. And you are quite familiar with the proposed building permit allocation system and the ordinance that's been developed. Just to give you a feel for what we shared with the Planning Commission, we brought them through the history of the work that this committee has done and the full council has done over the course of at least the past year, looking at the various information and how we did it along the way. We showed them some of the data and information that you all looked at as you considered putting a system like this in place. So we just gave them a feel for some of the numbers and some of the available information that had been provided, ranging from, you know, development activity to this slide that we've been using since the start of the comprehensive plan, and gave them some more history on how we ended up developing the ordinance. And that you in November as a council approved the first reading. And then we summarized the ordinance and the main features and characteristics of it, the different pools of permits, how multifamily was treated over the course of the entire program of 5 years rather than year by year, and that the system was a first come, first serve. Also that we have built in an annual evaluation and monitoring step so we can track and see how we're doing. Explain in more detail the number of permits that would be available, and note again that the Carolina Park and Liberty Hill Farms are excluded from those numbers. Shared with them the table that's contained in the ordinance, also showed them where we were in terms of 2018, in the number of permits that had been issued up until that point, so a little over 900, and you see the categories of single versus townhome versus accessory dwelling units in that regard. I believe we only did one apartment multifamily development of 280 units in 2018. We talked about how you could do a one-for-one exchange and the low-income slash affordable housing exclusion, and the various mechanics and system procedures that we would utilize as the ordinance would be administered. Shared with them the schedule that we would be coming back to you, the council, and then ultimately the opportunity is there if you're ready to consider it at next week's council meeting. We then summarized some of the concerns that we, or issues that we had been raised along the way as this has been moving forward, and you've heard some of those repeated, guarantee or no guarantee in a first-come, first-served system, say that all applicants would receive a permit. It's as you come along, and we're set up that we would just basically assign a number to a permit application and monitor it whenever it comes in. And so a lot of what we developed was for simplicity and understanding and for staff administering the ordinance. Concerns about runs on permit applications that might overwhelm the system, how many permits were in each pool. And so, the discussion is, if you think the townhome allocation ought to be a different number, suggest one. And we could, consider those kinds of things. And all the way to the end, why even consider this at all, based on various factors. We also shared with the Planning Commission a couple of potential changes that we suggested based on what we had been hearing. One is that we want to make it clear that if we didn't use the permits available in any given pool, say, for instance, we didn't use the townhome in a six-month period or a one-year period, those wouldn't be shifted and moved over to multifamily or go over to the single-family detached. They would just sit there in the system and be available in the future. We've had questions about, did we really want to do just, quote-unquote, low-income housing, or should that be broadened to include the work that we've been talking about in terms of affordable or workforce, where you would up the income level there to be able to account for the cost of housing in Mount Pleasant. And so we gave the Planning Commission an option. You could either go the way it was drafted or in a new way if you wanted to consider the workforce. And we also added language that would allow us as a staff to deal with things that were unexpected, where we could publish and produce administrative materials, rules. For instance, our folks have to rectify permit fees collected in a given day. So if we have a lot of permits come in and they come in at 4:20 p.m., we can't manage that. So we might have to have some timing or other limits. So we just want to make sure we wouldn't be changing the core elements of the code. We would just be able to publish and produce information that would help us administer it. And so these were those suggested pieces and changes. Planning Commission did nothing with any of these changes, so they didn't weigh in one way or the other, although they heard comment on several of those. So we had 10 speakers, lots of folks asking for clarifications and modifications at the public hearing. And you see here and in your staff report a list of some of the things that we heard, ranging from, uncertainty. Particularly, we hear a lot about smaller builders versus production or large tract developers. The effect on the market. Again, a rush. Will we have a rush? And will the large builder developer take all of the permits that were available, leaving none for other users? So after their discussion and hearing those, Planning Commission voted 7-0 to recommend that the ordinance be denied, and we've listed here some of the items that they listed, again, ranging from things like the timing with the comp plan, including ADUs, which some of them believed shouldn't be included in the system, the natural slowing and the reduced amount of developable land in the community anyway. Also, the point about a building permit system is being sort of applied at the very end of a development process when folks have entitlements and zoning and subdivision plan approvals, and now at the very end they're unable to move forward through with their plans on those prior approvals. We've also heard this through the comprehensive plan discussion, just the concern generally about fiscal implications by limiting the number of dwellings that can be constructed in a year, how it might apply to developments already under construction, and then again, questions about different procedural points within the ordinance itself. So with that, that summarizes where we are and their recommendation, and we have additional reference data or other information, and we're happy to answer questions that the committee has.
Okay. Is there anyone who wants to speak on this? Okay. One, two, three, Will. Okay. Okay. Did you have a question before we hear the speakers?
You showed a list of the Planning Commission, and there was a list of that slide right there. Reading the minutes, I didn't see that as action taken by them to bring back to us. Was it?
Which piece? They listed all of these are two different. Okay. These are the same list.
Came from Planning Commission members,
right,
during the course of
the discussion. So and this was the basis.
Vote.
To do anything with any one of these, they were just listing the points that they raised, and those collectively were the basis of their recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mayor? And if you would, on this side, start in that way, if you just, well, there's not room to stand up, just as you're close to the podium, if you would give us your name and address and a couple of minutes here.
Thank you. Will Haney, 316 Mallard Court, Mount Pleasant. First of all, I want to thank this committee for the work you've been doing for at least half a year, maybe longer, to come up with this plan. And I know that much has been made over the Planning Commission's vote. I know I got calls about it all over the holidays from the media, which I tried to answer as best I could. But I want to mention a couple of things. First of all, I think everybody who is sitting on this council now is here because we promised growth management to the people of Mount Pleasant. And this is an example of the downside of the arm's length that we keep on purpose between the elected officials and the appointed officials on the Planning Commission. We don't influence them. We don't sit and watch their meetings. At least I don't. I don't think most of us do. We don't tell them how to vote. We don't tell them how to think. And that's the way it's supposed to be. But in this case, I think had they maybe come and sat in on our meetings for a year, or those of you in the room who spoke out against this publicly to the media and everything, had you been a part of this process over the past year, all of those questions can be answered. Are there ways we can tweak this and make it better, like talk about pro rata and the timing and all that? Sure. But that does not affect the principle of what we are doing and what we have been openly calling for at least a year, and that is permit allocation system. One reason is protection of quality of life, which our citizens demanded of the people that they put in office. And the second reason is we had our staff calculate all the numbers, building permits, impact fees, effect on tax revenues. And if you remember, and I did this in my State of the Town address in June, at a 3.45% growth rate, which is about what we've had over the last 5 years, it is unsustainable on our town's infrastructure. Our calls to police and fire at a 3.45% growth rate were up over 50% over the last 5 years. Our school enrollment over the last 7 years has gone up 2,490 students, and we are very thankful for what the school district has done in building all the new schools that we've had, and we're getting ready to get a second high school, but that only happens maybe once a decade if you're fortunate. The other thing is that the calls to public services were up from 5,000 a year to 17,000 a year at a 3.45% growth rate. That is unsustainable, and the last point I'll make before I run out of time is we're not manipulating the market. We're not saying year to year how many we want. We figured out based on our taxation rate, our spending rate, and the infrastructure that our taxpayers have already paid for, we figured out what the peak would be, and that's about 2%. And that's what we hit. If it doesn't get there, we're not manipulating it to say, oh, we'd like to see 455. We're hitting what the peak is because we took an oath to take care of this town, its people, and its infrastructure, and this is a way to do it. And I hope the committee, if we tweak it, that's fine, but let's don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Thank you.
Will? Patrick?
Good morning. My name is Patrick Arnold, and I serve as the CEO of the Charleston Home Builders Association. First, I'd like to submit a written statement from our partners at the Charleston Realtors Association on their opposition to these permit allocation system. And on behalf of the HBA and the building community, we strongly oppose the building permit allocation program as it goes against both staff's recommendation and council's own admission in the past that it does not work. Mount Pleasant Permit Allocation Plan was just highlighted in Forbes magazine as policy that actually makes traffic and infrastructure worse, not better. Furthermore, it violates private property rights and will further expose the town to costly lawsuits, something that has already strained the town's finances. Further limiting residential construction will limit supply, which continues to inflate housing costs and undermine the town's plan to address affordability. It's simple supply-demand economics. If you artificially restrict supply, prices will skyrocket even further than we see now. Last, the town is highly dependent on revenue from home construction, and by council's own admission, in May of this year, is running out of money and will further be forced to either cut services or raise taxes. While we understand the need for infrastructure improvements, this will make those efforts harder, and we respectfully ask that you consider market-friendly solutions such as TIF districts and other programs. For the health of the town, the taxpayers, and the housing industry, we urge you not to implement a building permit allocation program, as Planning Commission has warned will cause way more problems than solutions. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Will Jenkinson, 250 River Oak Drive here in Mount Pleasant. I am the broker in charge of Carolina One New Homes here, and we represent regional and local developers and home builders. Currently in this town, we have seven communities, four of which are in the final stage, either waiting on a signature to record a plat or finishing that process, or within the next couple of months, finishing communities. I will note that all four of those communities that are nearing completion have been investing over $10 million just to get to this point by these private and local developers. All of these are under 30 units. So we're talking about small infill communities that don't put a big strain on the resources and infrastructure. In fact, most of these, if not all of these, are already in well-infrastructured areas of the town. And you're putting a big burden on these local developers and home builders because these developers are going out and spending all this money, have gained the approvals from the town, and then they're at the point of being able to sell lots to individuals or home builders. And now if there are no building permits, if they or a shortage of them, they run out, you're putting them in harm's way or risking of not being able to sell their lots and build homes for future home builders. So I think we need to look at some type of either it's a grandfathering or exception for some of these that are nearing completion or smaller communities by these local private guys. Two major concerns that I have with the proposed allocation program. Number one, and first and foremost, is the first come, first serve. What that does to the local smaller builder and developer is it puts them in a disadvantage when you're competing with larger national home builders that have deeper pockets, more resources, more manpower to put in for permits and pay for permits in bulk. They could take away the number of permits from these smaller communities, thus impacting the smaller local builder. Secondly, my biggest second concern that I want to highlight is the number of permits that are being allocated for townhouses. The number of 60 on an annual basis, if you simply look at the last 6 years, it's averaged right at 130. So you're taking that over 50% down from what the average has been. I will point out two townhomes. While they don't fall under affordable workforce housing, townhomes typically provide a more affordable home for residents in this town. And by restricting them to lower numbers, you're thus going to impact the affordability of people to purchase in this town. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Yes, sir. He gives your name and address in a couple of minutes, please.
Yeah, I'm Steve Kendrick, 1052 Wharf Indigo Place in Mount Pleasant. My name is Steve Kendrick, and I'm the owner of Structures Building Company. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak about the permit allocation program before you. I'm a custom home builder, and Mount Pleasant is where I've built the vast majority of our clients' homes over the last 19 years. I'm lucky to be a resident of Mount Pleasant, as are 11 of my 19 employees and their families. My company narrowly made it through the last permit allocation program and the recession that followed it. We're one of the lucky ones, and that's why I'm here to speak in opposition to this permit allocation program in its entirety, but also the specifics of how it is written. I would encourage you to let planning and zoning regulations more naturally dictate where growth occurs and how many homes are approved to be built. Approving a subdivision, large or small, but then restricting permit access is a taking. We are the builder of the Edwards Track in the old Mount Pleasant. This small subdivision has all of its approvals, but having read the guidelines of the permit allocation program, I can easily envision not having adequate access to permits to build in an area where the infrastructure already exists. Ironically, we may lose clients who decide to build with larger builders, able to pull more permits further outside the infill areas of Mount Pleasant, where perhaps the infrastructure isn't in place. If you're going to go against the Planning Commission's recommendation and approve the permit allocation program, I ask that you revise the guidelines and do more to protect the small custom builder. The first-come, first-serve approach outlined in the draft proposal does not serve my company well. My recollection in the last permit allocation program was that we were at least guaranteed one permit per quarter and four per year. As a custom builder, we file for permits as a one-of-a-kind design is completed, priced and contracted to be built. Any of you who have built the custom home know that it's a long, arduous process as it is. As written, if permits are used up in a given six-month period, I may then need to wait another six-plus months for my plans to be reviewed and a permit issued. Then my client is going to need to have his house repriced because 6 months have gone by. The difference of 6 months in my line of work not only impacts our client's ability to build a new home, it's a difference between one of my employees having a job or not having a job, and I don't think that's your intention. I understand and respect that many of you were elected on a managed growth platform, but as we hear rumblings of a market-driven housing slowdown, I first ask that you vote against the permit allocation program in its entirety. If you won't do that, I at least ask that you bring builders like me into the tent to help revise the program as drafted and protect our business and our employees. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Okay, if you would give us your name and address in a couple minutes.
Good morning. My name is Scott Elferdink. I live at 982 Cliffwood Drive in the Groves. I am currently the developer of the Edwards Place property in the Old Village. We are well represented here by Will and Steve, and so I'm probably just piling on. But however, I am one of those people who have made a tremendous investment into this property. And we put this property under contract in October of 2017. We took us over a year to get the project approved and designed, and now we were finally received our land disturbance permit to start in construction last month. None of this probably would have happened if we would have had any inclination that there was a permit allocation system. I know that we had to find different financing because our bank backed out from us due to the uncertainty of the building allocation program. We had to go seek private investment. Unlike everybody else, it's a concern. It may not be a concern due to slowdown, and it's really an unknown. But to approve something, allow somebody to invest in this and move forward, and then to restrict it, if this was done to somebody else's line of work, I think they would have a serious problem with it, and could lead to some legal action that nobody wants. But I ask you to deny this, and like Steve, I think there is some better ways, and I think bringing all parties to the table would help the program. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. There was someone else? Yes, sir. If you would give us your name and address in a couple of minutes, please.
Good morning. My name is Tom Massey. I'm a Mount Pleasant resident. I live at 24 Salty Tide Cove. I'm a local land developer. I have two projects that the construction is complete right now. One of them is 24 lots, and the other one is 16 lots. I've invested $8 million in these two projects because I was given permission to build these subdivisions by the town of Mount Pleasant, and I went out and did everything I could. One of them, I turned in my subdivision plat last week. I had to scramble to get everything done, all the inspections, I got it in, but unfortunately, there's a backlog right now. This whole thing has put a tremendous pressure on staff to approve plats and to make inspections. And so here I am. If this thing passes on Tuesday and I don't get my plat recorded before Tuesday, I could lose building permit. And my builders don't buy lots from me if they can't get building permit. And to me, that represents taking my property from me without compensating me for it. I'm very angry. I didn't sleep last night. I would appreciate if y'all would consider grandfathering in these projects that are about to be plat recorded. I would appreciate a deferral of the implementation to allow the backlog of permits and subdivision plats to get recorded and for everything to happen in an orderly manner. If it's just a five-year program, why are we in such a hurry to get started on Tuesday? You know, I really would like to see the thing defeated. I've been through one permit allocation program before. It wasn't that bad, but this one's going to be really bad, and it's going to really hurt me personally, financially, hurt my home builder. The people who have agreed to buy a home won't be able to buy them. That's not right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else who would like to speak? Going once? Nope. Okay. All right. The floor is closed for public comment on this, and we'll start. Does anyone have anything they wish to say on this?
I also have an issue with the first-come, first-serve approach because I'm concerned about people coming in and kind of scooping up all the permits. So I would like there to be a closer examination of that aspect of the program so that we can ensure that the permits are more equitably distributed among home builders.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Do we have any idea how many projects are out there in which we've given the developers that go ahead to develop lots that will be affected? How many homes will those, how many developments are out there, and how many homes will that produce?
We have some.
I don't expect you to have that.
We have some information, Mr. O'Rourke, on the projects that we've been sort of that are active, so where permits have been issued over the past year, year and a half. So they've been out there. It wouldn't necessarily include something new that hasn't been platted yet. So Mr. Massey's 16 or 24. Right. So those would be on top. our numbers show that in a number of subdivisions, the total number of lots that were platted is around 1,200. Permits have been issued for 700 of those 1,200, and there are about less than 500 lots available in a variety of subdivisions. Some of those are townhome, and some of those are single family. And this is the kind of information that we can monitor and track, and we do weekly, and then generate monthly reports on that.
And those numbers include Mr. Massey's project and also the one in the village?
They don't.
Well, I think that's kind of where my question was. What have we given developers the go-ahead to start developing their property that they'll now be faced to go into the permit allocation program?
So those that are still in that prior to platting and recording lots phase. I'm not sure.
And maybe
we've been looking at some of the looking at some of those numbers and provided some of those numbers, and we had it in earlier reports in terms of sketch plans that the Planning Commission had approved, and the numbers were maybe Kevin Mitchell's. Kevin here? Do you remember, Kevin, what we had in terms of, like, in the past year?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact number, but there's not many. We haven't seen any really new subdivisions for the past year.
But we can add that to the mix and bring back information that would identify sort of those that are in the process.
I would appreciate that. I am personally in favor of getting control of growth, but I'm also a person that appreciates fair at the end of the day. And what we do from one point forward is one thing, but I think we're going to have to look at fairness as well.
Question that I have, Jeff, we have the ones you're seeing out there. Would it be possible to put, rather than pro rata, perhaps a cap on that everyone could get some number? Because I think we're hearing from small builders here that are, you know, can I get an idea how many buildings you're talking about? How many houses? Or
I can give
them. Yeah. Well.
In terms of the total number of units?
Yeah.
I can count at least 10 communities that I know of in this town that are under development.
Oh, that's, yeah, you need to go up here to the microphone. Yeah, I mean, what I'm looking for is 40, 20. I mean, do you have any that are larger than 40?
I would say actually most of the ones that are under, I know of about at least 10 communities that are currently under development, either have started development or finishing waiting on a signature to record a plat, that I know of just by going through the field and understanding all of those. None of them are over 50 per community. They're all 50 or less in the number that are out there that have been given approvals, invested millions of dollars, and not yet been able to start selling lots or building houses.
Okay, thanks. If you just, I'm sorry, if you just step up there, that way we can be recorded.
Edwards Place has 10 lots.
10 lots, okay.
40.
Yes, sir, if you would come over here. I'm sorry to keep running you back and forth, but so we can get it recorded.
I have 24 lots that all I need is a signature to record the plat, as far as I know. I have 16 lots. The construction is 100% complete. So that's 40 total. Very small project.
Okay, 24. All right, thanks.
16.
Okay, thanks, sir.
And those are on the scale, Mr. Bustos, of the projects that we're talking about here that are in play. 41 platted lots, 47, 43, 22, 21, 43, some a little bit larger. And obviously some of the bigger developments, Oyster Point, for instance, had 357 lots, but they've received 317 permits, so there's 40 left. So those are the kinds of numbers that we've been seeing, too. The 20, 30, 40 range is pretty typical.
Okay. Ms. Landing, if you would step up the microphone.
Hello, everyone. Kathy Landing, 2114 Seawee Indian Court. As I mentioned on the night of our first reading, I definitely feel strongly that normally the free market is the way to dictate how businesses grow and how an area develops, and that the exception that I was bringing up here, which was to for staff who have spent quite a bit of time putting this permit allocation program together, was because of the fact that our citizenry had definitely said we need to slow residential growth. In fact, they said slow growth, period, but I think it was because they were seeing all the traffic congestion, blah, 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 and And I felt strongly, and as economic development chair, that we needed more businesses to serve our people. And we saw an awful lot in the past of areas that the comprehensive plan specifically had zoned for commercial, both for businesses and hopefully companies, bringing in industry other than what we have to diversify. We saw a lot of areas that because of the downturn in 2008 and beyond, ended up going to residential. And I think this caused a lot of unintended consequences, perhaps intended consequences, that we're still dealing with today. Perfect example of this, not to put anybody down in terms of where they live, but Bessemer Road is an example where it was a commercial node, according to the comprehensive plan, ended up going residential, and now we're seeing a tremendous amount of homes going in there and townhomes that are just causing huge, huge traffic congestion. So let me just say that based on what we have heard, and the mayor is right, Mayor Haney's correct, we did not hear a lot of detail before our first reading. So even though months and months and months of work went in by our staff to try to get this right, the first time we're hearing anything is basically the Planning Commission meeting, where now there's a whole lot of outcry. Based on this, I know I personally would recommend that we defer, not to kick the can down the road, but because I think we need a lot more information, and or we need to consider a different way to go about this. I'm not convinced anymore that us kind of trying to control from the government level the free market is the right answer for this. And also, by the way, last comment, we have a comprehensive plan that's about to come out, and we haven't even seen it yet. So maybe this, which is a very important decision, maybe this is something that at least needs to be deferred beyond the comprehensive plan. Thank you.
Thank you. But I also have to say this committee and the staff has worked on this, and there have been a wealth of minutes that you could have availed yourself to. So it all takes us a little effort. Okay. Anyone else? Bob?
Yeah. First, let me apologize for my late arrival today. It's good to be here. Happy New Year to everybody. So I just have a couple of questions, and they've already been addressed through the conversation, just say so, and I'll address them outside of the committee. But first thing is Planning Commission, reading through the minutes of Planning Commission. I thought the commission did a good job of sort of raising several questions. I think Mr. Neal did a good job of putting those in a bullet point in the minutes in terms of the concerns of the commission. I would have rather that they had not turned it down, rather just deferred and gotten the information they needed, because I think those are valid questions and they're coming up again today. So a particular concern for me in that discussion was the request for financial information. I know we had talked about this several times, about making sure that we understand the financial impact of any system. And to date, I have not seen that. I'm not sure if that's been presented or not to council, but I think that's a critical piece of information that we have to have before moving forward. Just Mr. O'Rourke does a good job of kind of reminding council on a weekly basis of all of the needs that are coming up in the future and how we're going to pay for them. And I think before we take a step like a permit allocation, we need to make sure that we understand clearly what that implication or what the impact of that's going to be on our budget. So I think that's a piece of information that I really need to have before I can move forward with voting for any kind of system. A couple of questions on the last time, Jeff. One of the speakers mentioned that in the last round of permit allocation that small builders were guaranteed at least one per quarter and four per year. Number one, is that correct? And number two, if it was, is there a reason why that's not built in this time?
Yes, I believe that is correct, that there was a mechanism that ensured that you got at least one. I know from and wasn't here during administering the ordinance, the staff perspective is it was very difficult being able to deal and track and monitor that you might get portions of an allotment or parts of your development. So you got one quarter, one the next. It might take you several quarters to accumulate enough permits to build one townhome block of five units. And so it was in the maybe too simplistic, but in our effort to make this ordinance easier to administer, that's why we didn't include that kind of provision in the draft that we have today. The other is that we talked about is sort of impact is impact is impact. A house and the impact of it, we were trying to divorce ourselves from, and then how do you define big builder, small developer, local, not local, and then trying to sort those out. And I understand from the last ordinance there were all kinds of things, and you can tell that the ordinance was amended over time to close holes and loopholes where folks created LLCs and corporations, special kinds of maneuvering in order to be able to even overcome those accommodations that were in the ordinance. So a lot of it is the staff history and experience with the prior system.
Okay, and then also just kind of piggybacking on Tom's previous comment, I also want to make sure that we do what's fair here to the extent we can. So in the last building permit allocation system, where was that line drawn in terms of where people were in the process that at one point you were allowed to build and at some point you needed to go through the permit allocation? Where was that line drawn then, and is it the same in the current draft?
It would just been in the data that ordinance,
same as this.
Same as it was last time. Okay. Thank you.
Just to answer your question, with townhomes and permit allocation, one problem that came up was just one that Jeff described, that folks, a developer came in, wanted to build two sets of townhomes, four each, and they wound up with seven permits. And because townhomes were under a single-family permit, and what we did then was took townhomes and put them under multifamily, and then they could come in and get the number in order to build whole buildings.
Yep.
So there were things like that that were changed to accommodate folks in building. As we've gone through that and I asked the question, I think we've come up with, I would think here 40 would be a good number, and rather than just having it free flow at the when we begin this, I think if we said that there was a cap of 40 and folks could come in, developers could come in and get up to 40 permits, you know, we have a gentleman with 10 and 15. If we said 40, they would get their permits, and there would be a number of permits left over, which would go back into the pool, which would carry over to the following year. So it's not a percentage, but a cap. And after listening, I think, even with Mr. Jenkinson's 10 communities, you said, that are about, 40. If each community came in and asked for 40, I think they would be in good shape. So perhaps a change to cap the number of permits as it's going forward, rather than just throwing the door open and saying first come, first serve, because I likewise, there are big organizations with a lot of staff and a lot of people come in and could request 100, 200 permits, and this would protect them. And I think we do need to protect the smaller businesses, but then again, we do need to have some grip on this the growth that's happening. And also, as Jeff said, these have all come through our permit allocation last time when there were different situations. They were analyzed, and the ordinance was tweaked. The idea is not to put anyone out of business, not to absolutely favor one over the other, but I think the residents are expecting something to be done. We're trying to make this as palatable as possible, but we also need to make certain that it's effective. And as this has kind of fallen out, as I've spoken to people, I thought around 40 would be correct. And as it turns out now, I think a cap of 40 would at least ensure that people keep moving forward, even if they have some in the queue now, and we could move on in the implementation of this.
Well, I think also that just the fact that we're really running out of big parcels, and a lot of development will be smaller in scale going forward. Either that, or we're going to push development out to the donut holes and the county properties, which we'll have no say over. So I think whatever we can do to maintain control over the development, but also provide flexibility to the smaller developers who are going to have these smaller parcels. And I can't think of too many places in town where you're going to be able to get 200 homes in anymore. It's, you know, it's going to be the 25 to 40 home subdivision. So I think that's probably an area that we can strengthen up in this for sure.
I think we just need to be careful that people don't game the system that happened in the past where people were spinning off LLCs in order to get larger permits, and maybe tying it to the community rather than to the name of the developer. That might be one way to do it. So if it's a bigger, I don't know, that, just throwing that out there.
Yeah, and there were, as one who's on council, and there were some interesting methods that were tried. Developers sold single lots to people, and then they would come and get the permit, and they would bring the permit back and give it to the developer. And I get it, but this is what we're working on now, and I don't. That was then. This is now, and I think we need. I think a cap of 40 would protect the smaller builder, and not necessarily disadvantage the larger builder, because they're going to come in with a request for 100 or so, but, you know, it's like eating an elephant. You can only eat it one bite at a time.
There are a couple of time considerations, and the ordinance spells it out, and we understand that it's a fear that somebody would get 400 of the 410 or whatever the number is, but they have to be ready to construct and build. And our building permit requirements already, require you to move forward. When that permit is issued, I mean, if somebody got 100 permits, they would need to be ready to build 100 units within 6 months under the ordinance. And if they don't proceed with that allocation or permit, it goes back into the pool. So another part is, how quickly can anybody reasonably develop lots at that rate anyway? And that's one of the factors that staff has accounted for in not getting as maybe concerned as the fear has been explained or expressed. I mean, they've got to be ready to go when they're going to secure a permit and move forward.
Got it. Okay. And another issue that was raised about affordable housing, I believe that the ordinance currently has it set at 80%. Is that correct? Versus
yes.
80% and under?
And that's the option that we provided to Planning Commission, was to open that range and make it go to the 80 to 120 range, and that is the option that we provided. So any input on those other components that we shared with Planning Commission as we move forward would be helpful.
Yeah, I think I'm fine with making it 120% and under, but I don't want to foreclose or forestall under 80%, because if you look at a teacher's income, you know, that's below 80%, or someone working at a restaurant or working at Walmart. And if there's developers who are wanting to work in that space, I don't want to foreclose that. So I think upping it to 120% to
120
to help our policemen and firefighters would be a positive change.
My only comment, and this is where I tell myself I should just shut up, but I hope that as we make these decisions, we don't forget the reason that we're doing this, and that was to give us some relief from the growth and the traffic and everything else. And as we do this, we spend all this time on the residential part. I hate to say this, but I don't know what change 10 homes in the old village is going to make to controlling anything, quite frankly. And or 14 over here. As long as we're infill, I can give you a lot of arguments of why that might not be a bad idea. But
I think we're trying to protect ourselves from these massive things that just show up one day that cause everybody to drive in from all kinds of places and control the growth. So I don't even know what I'm saying, quite frankly. I'll be quiet right now. But just don't forget why in the world we're doing this in the first place.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like that there's some interest on the committee to have this work some more. Do we need a motion to defer, or can we just kind of bring it back next month to see how we are on these items?
Well, what I would like to see is I think there are a couple of points here. Obviously, the percentage, 80 and 120, I believe it was, and the cap of 40, so that everyone has a place at the table pretty much from what we've heard. I'd like to see us go ahead and integrate those couple of things and take it to council and see if there is more to discuss or less to discuss because, you know, at some point when all of council weighs in, just as we've had different things, there are going to be other points. I'd like to keep bringing this back to council. And at that point, if with these changes that has addressed the concerns, we can have final reading. If it does not, then entire council can formulate their points and send us back to this committee, and we can work on it, even if we have to have a special committee meeting. Yes, ma'am.
I also think we need to lower that cap for the townhome multifamily because I think under the ordinance it's only how many per year for townhomes for multifamily? Because I think 40 would be
60
right,
total.
So 40 would be the majority of that. So maybe drop it to 20 or 10 for a smaller number for townhomes because then one person could apply for 40, get all of it, and then there's only 20 left for that six-month period.
A distinction between single
and multifamily. I think a distinction in cap would be.
With a cap.
Yeah.
So it's a cap on a pool.
Because the 40 cap makes sense for the single family homes or the developments are 16 to 24 homes, mm-hmm. but there's so few permits for townhomes that I think having that cap be so high will restrict the number of developers that have access to those.
I've got to think through that one.
Okay.
but if I can, but I support what you said. I think the more we can bring this to all nine of us and have that discussion, this is important. This is really important, and we shouldn't just blow through it. So I think I like the idea of bringing it back to full council with the changes that we talked about, but also the part about making sure that smaller builders have a fair shot at so much per quarter or whatever. Some of these things so that, and Bob, I hear what you're saying, but just get us a little closer to what it is. If we have to defer, I think that's better. But I think all nine really have opinions, and the sooner we can get all nine opinions out, the more we can tackle it, I think.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I just think having nine people discuss something that we haven't sort of provided some more structure with, this creates a lot of directions. Nice. I'd prefer maybe that we take some of these changes, put them in place, deal with anything that comes from that, get the financial information, answer some of the questions from Planning Commission, and once we feel comfortable that we've addressed sort of the outstanding issues, I think that's a better time to bring it forward. But my other question is there a timeline on second reading?
I don't know.
I don't believe so.
No, we can just kind of keep it up.
6 months.
Okay, so we've got plenty of time for that. Okay, but that's just my preference. I think having a more focused discussion with nine is better than sort of all of the issues that we have out there at this point. But whatever, I'm okay either way.
Yeah, well, I just think it's best that we report to council
and the public.
And the public because it's important all the way around. And you're right, we don't want to do this in a bum's rush. And I think we've been very good about, up to this point, we didn't do it in a week or a month. We've been at this for months. So if I could, I'd like to have a motion to recommend to council this as amended. And, of course, if council wants to send us back, we'll certainly take it. And if they want to move it forward, and as a, you know, with more amendments, we can do that as well. But this gives us some options.
I think we should state what these amendments are before we do that.
Yeah, we had the 40 and the 100. And
how about the one per quarter for smaller builders? Because that's not in there now.
Well,
minimum of
they'd get 40.
So he's changed the technique would then change just to put a cap on. It would still be effectively first come, first serve, but no more than 40, or in the case of townhomes, some lesser number when you would come in.
Last time under the pro rata, if a large builder, a smaller builder, and a homeowner came in, they would take the permits, they would give the individual home builder, like if you wanted to build a home, you got a permit.
Right.
You automatically got a permit, and there were eight other people. Those eight people automatically got one permit, and then the balance of the permits in a pro rata fashion were given to the small builder and the large builder. So if the small builder said, I want 10,
yep,
he might get 8.
Right.
And the large builder who wanted 400,
yeah, right,
would get 300.
Right.
But with 40, everyone who comes
gets
in some cases 15 or 12 up to 40.
Right.
And, you know, if someone comes in and says, I want 12, then obviously of the potential that he could get 40, he'll have the others go back into the pool.
That makes sense. I'm slow.
That's okay, Tom.
All right.
Okay. When your back hurts, things
yeah, there work. You go. That's right.
Just to clarify for staff, and we may be slow too, are you expecting the ordinance to be amended to reflect these changes that you're talking about, the actual wording of the ordinance, or that we would outline sort of those key points and issues at next Tuesday's council meeting?
I would think that we would have them outlined so that council can say, I like that, I don't like that.
But not necessarily hardwired right into the ordinance yet.
Yeah. Thank you. That was one of my question is I wanted a clarification on the motion because I didn't want to make sure that we weren't recommending second reading with these changes.
Yeah, no.
Okay, then I'm good with that.
So are we essentially recommending deferral then, or are we just sort of recommending just to bring it to full council?
A motion to report this to full council I think would be good. And anyone at that point who says I'm good with this can make a motion to say I recommend approval because we are second reading as amended because we do have – we have had first reading, but council could also send it back and say, you know, the 40 is good, the 120, and at a minimum, I think what's going to happen is if they like those two features, they're going to say, make a motion to bring it back to council for second reading right, as amended.
Right.
Yeah, I move to send this to full council for further discussion.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is everyone clear on the motion and everything? Okay, any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. Jeff, we squared away?
Yes, sir.
Raj.
On that one.
Got it. All right.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet. Okay, now we're talking amendment to the zoning code to add, no. Rory, we just did that. Number four.
And I'm trying to get there.
That was good discussion, guys.
Yeah.
Good discussion.
Okay, this next amendment to the zoning code deals with small wireless facilities. You are familiar with this. It's come through the process previously, and the Planning Commission had seen it one time, but as we continue to work on it at the request of representatives of the wireless industry, and we've also met with providers of the utilities where these facilities would be located, we've made adjustments and changes
And Planning Commission, again, recommended approval as changed. And just by way of a quick recap, remember that this is a new technology being utilized more and more by the industry, locating these smaller, and you may or may not even see them on these examples, these smaller wireless features in order to get the signal and the information out closer to where folks are. This applies to locating these within rights of way only. So that was the request. This was built on a model ordinance created by the industry and the municipal association. This doesn't change what we already have in our ordinance for the larger towers and facilities. So that's effectively part A. This is part B, where we add provisions to cover this particular technology, which our ordinance previously didn't cover. And again, Planning Commission recommended approval originally. We asked you to delay it. We've been working on it, and we believe we're in a good position at this point to be able to move forward to first reading of the ordinance. Just some key features. I mean, we lay out in the ordinance how it all works. There are fees and costs for submittal and review of applications. Federal law, state law require certain time frames for us to respond. We can't put these things on hold forever. So there are timelines in there. We regulate and deal with the heights of these structures to make sure that, you know, they're not obtrusive or changing the character along the road right away. A key part that we've added since the first time was this section on design guidelines. Well, if we know what we're looking for or what we're not wanting in our community, give some guidance as to, you know, the character, the way these are constructed, how they might look. And so we've spent considerable time working on these design standards, which we would apply as these permits are reviewed. We also specify a hierarchy, like our existing ordinance does for the larger towers, of what kind of facilities you like to see. If there's an existing pole or a structure there, use that first versus going and installing something new. An existing wooden pole or replacing an old wooden pole with a new one to have one of these on it is our last resort. So we sort of lay that out in that fashion. So you see the points and the language that we've changed. And again, these are some of the illustrations that we would include within the design guidelines so that the industry knows where, you know, what we are looking for as a community. And that's why it's been important for us to take what was a model ordinance, but be able to craft it and adjust it and refine it to fit our community, as opposed to stock off the shelf and just going with, you know, what had been produced previously. So that's a summary. I believe Mr. Mitchell may be here from AT&T that we worked with. Staff, we also met with SCE&G. As the owner of many of these structures and poles, they've having more and more experience across the state dealing with local community ordinances that address small wireless facilities. So they gave us a lot of insight and suggestions for improvements to the ordinance. It's not perfect, but we can apply it and then learn from that and move forward in the future. So we're at a position where we would recommend that this move forward and we get it set up for council adoption or first reading with the amendments that we show in red in your copy of the ordinance that's included.
Is cantenna a new word?
I believe so. Not a cantina, though.
The question I have is that a one-time fee, then they get to just put it on the poles, or is an ongoing revenue source for the town?
It's a one-time as structured here. This is an application review fee. We haven't talked about, since we may not even own the pole or the facility, or it may be state right-of-way, we haven't done anything on the revenue side of, now that could be a consideration on a town pole in a town right-of-way. That could be talked about, but we've approached it only from the zoning standpoint at this point. So it'd be an application review fee.
Yes, sir.
Jeff, we have a variety of covenants, restrictions, and subdivisions all across the town. What role does the HOA covenants play in approvals or design or?
I'm not sure if their covenants would necessarily apply to what happens within the rights of way. And the owner, I mean, the utility provider and owner, and then the FCC, I mean, you could conceivably get to a point where neighborhoods and communities would all say, we don't want any of these in our neighborhood, and they wouldn't be able to go anywhere. And that's the purpose of the federal law, is to ensure that this utility, this availability is there. We haven't discussed anything in terms of homeowners associations doing something different than what would be allowed under town ordinance.
I just ask because in several places in this document, it talks about preserving, doing things in character with communities and making sure that we don't have things that are out of character. So just thinking of the amount of the town that's under some sort of HOA and planned developments and making sure we don't end up with things in those communities that look out of place, that's all.
We also have lots of locations where utility poles are underground. We're also, as a community, moving to underground utilities on major roadways. And so there's provisions in here that address that. If a pole is placed and ultimately we go in and underground the lines, we would come back and say, we don't want that facility, the only thing sticking up in the right-of-way, you know, move it, remove it. And those provisions are built into the ordinance to deal with the aesthetic character and quality. So it's a balance between everybody's interest in being able to use these and then community aesthetics and character.
And this is only along rights of way?
Yes.
Because I'm also wondering, we had an issue here, it was a year ago, maybe a little bit more than a year ago, about a community that had a pole going in and for cell service, and there was a big controversy about that. So this could actually be something that could bring more service to areas maybe that don't
otherwise have it. As we understand it, they typically utilize this in areas where there is high concentrations of folks. So whether you would see it on every light pole running through, you know, up Highway 17, probably not the case. But it allows them to expand the bandwidth of the system, say, around facilities or shopping centers where you have a lot of demand all at one time.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Is there any – it just feels to me like when we discuss the big towers, that there's revenue for the town for these things. Do you foresee any – oops, sorry. Do you foresee any opportunities for the town to even be proactive in us doing this with a continued source of revenue coming in? Because, you know, there's – it's going to become a bigger issue as we go on. Moving data is going to be big. And if they already have the structures and they already have it all, there's a cost in there. I mean, we pay franchise fees on cable. We do all of that. And I don't know, but I'm just saying on the front end early on, it may be good to look at that. I know you're just talking about the design and things like that, which is good. But I was just curious to see, because we're getting it with the big towers, we're getting it with the other things, and this is just a prettier way to move data. And if they do that, maybe we could see something.
Franchise fees.
Yeah.
The franchise fees that we have are substantial. Mm-hmm. And any expansion long-term in the telecommunications industry is good for us and certainly our bottom line at the end of the day. Outside of that, we're restricting pushing anything further.
Yeah. All right.
So I'm so sorry to clarify. So we're restricted from saying you must rent this pole from us on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I mean, we years ago, the state of South Carolina allowed us to negotiate our own structures and how we impose fees. That structure was taken away from us by an act of the General Assembly, which has only left us with the power to impose one franchise fee, but leaves the nuts and bolts and some of the other details strictly to the provider only.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion for approval.
Okay. Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to recommend approval to town council. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. All right. Next is short-term rentals. Do you need a five-minute break?
I do.
Okay. We're going to take a five-minute pause.
Okay.
Maybe 10.
If I could call back to order from our pause, the Planning Development Committee of Council meeting. Okay, and just to bring us back to where we were, our next topic is the continuing discussion of proposed regulations for short-term rentals. Is there anyone, I imagine there are, who wants to speak on this before we, hold on, let me start over here, Lori. Go ahead. If you would give us your name and address in a couple of minutes, 2 minutes, and we'll be on our way.
Michelle Whitbeck, 712 Hibbins Grant Boulevard, Mount Pleasant. I'm commenting against the belief that short-term rental townhomes affect their neighbors negatively and that they are to blame for reducing affordable housing. My husband and I own a townhome that does not have an HOA. It is an end unit, and we have our guests parked directly next to our unit away from any other residence spaces. We have the backyard fenced in. We have only a small bistro set with two chairs in the back to reduce use and noise outside. Our next-door neighbors do not have a view of our guests' cars or them entering the front door because of thick bushes between the units. We have a fireproof wall between the units, which also serves as a sound barrier. So you see, our circumstance may be unique, but we do not infringe on our neighbors with our STR. We are against a strict owner-occupied ordinance on townhomes just because other townhomes have a different scenario. We ask that each STR is considered on a case-by-case situation with predetermined rules, such as ample parking for the number of guests, fire safety measures in place, etc. We also believe that restricting short-term rentals too much could actually backfire on the affordable housing issue that municipalities feel is so important to preserve. With restrictions, the demand for short-term rentals won't disappear if the supply of short-term rentals offered through services such as Airbnb and VRBO are cut back. The unmet demand would go to conventional hotels. But when there is more demand for hotels, more hotels get built. Hotel and apartment developments compete for the same scarce urban land, so more new hotels means fewer new apartments, and fewer apartments means higher rents. If so, then short-term rental restrictions may be a zero-sum game for affordability. In conclusion, we believe taxing short-term rentals and dedicating the tax revenue to affordable housing subsidies is a better option than banning non-owner-occupied short-term rentals. And please consider grandfathering in existing short-term rental townhomes with any regulations you impose. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lori? Okay, if you'd give us your name and address in a couple of minutes.
Laurie Bixler, 144 3rd Avenue. I'm sorry I missed the last meeting, and I think you'll be pleased to know that I'm going to miss the next meeting, too. I think we all are headed in the right direction, and I want to thank the committee for how things are proceeding, because I have been following along. I have some new topics to raise today, and so I'll try to make it as fast as possible. I want you to keep an eye on what's going on downtown, because as of last night, they've only permitted 175 properties, and they still have 1,600 illegal rentals out there on the computer system. And I think that's significant for you to know in proceeding. But what I'd like to do today in talking to you is ask you for things to help the owners. So far, I've only focused on what we need to stay legal. And I've come up with a few things that I'd like to ask you to consider. First of all, I acknowledge there can sometimes be a problem. I'm not in nirvana. I haven't had one. But let's just say there is a problem. I'd like you to consider a situation where the owner can actually call in if they know that there's a problem and the town is willing to send out the police to assist without penalty if the owner is the one who initiates the call.
I'll just interrupt right there. The police will always, if they're called, they'll come.
Yes, but the owner, I think you might have missed my point, Mr. Bustos, which is that the owner should not be penalized. Should there be some kind of penalty like a three strikes you're out or a house being disruptive? If the owner is the one who initiates to say, I've got a problem, I'd like to see a non-punitive situation where the owner is actually managing. I also would like to see you actually require noise aware to be installed in as you permit. to any house that might be, say, three bedrooms or over. I don't think you necessarily need noise aware in a one-bedroom rental, but it may be something that we can consider to control what could potentially be a bad apple in the bunch. Also, currently I'm following a situation in Colorado where an owner has had a problem and she is unable to get an eviction, and Airbnb is not helping. And without me going into too many details or any details, what I'd like you to do is consider a situation where the town can clear a path and help evict, have certain parameters where if a contract is broken or there's a subletting to more people than are allowed, that the town can assist with ensuring that an eviction actually happens, that the police will show and evict, because this town in Colorado will not do that.
Yeah. Lori.
Am I done already?
Yeah, but if you would
write them down. Okay.
You have my email.
Yes, I have everybody's email.
Okay.
Can I be clear on one thing that I thought I heard you say?
Yes, sir.
If there's a unit.
Yes.
And there's a problem that the police have to come.
Yes.
You don't want the owner of the unit in any way.
No. If a neighbor calls, the owner is a bad owner, assuming that the neighbor is not crazy. Okay? Because, you know. But what if the owner calls you? What if the owner calls the police and says, I've got some people in here who are having a domestic problem, or they are having a party. I'm afraid to go in by myself. Okay. I would like some help.
Okay.
So the owner is the one who's initiating and saying, I want to protect my neighbors. Will you assist me? So instead of penalizing the owner and saying we've got a problem, what I'm asking is the town, since there's going to be fees, there's going to be licensing, I'm asking that the owners also be supported. I'm trying to look at ways for this to be a positive partnership.
Lori, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think we do business that way. We don't penalize the person who calls the police. It's the person who's causing the ruckus who
Well, should you initiate like a three strikes you're out, then you would be penalizing.
Well, I think we'll have to
see. Okay. Am I done?
Yes, ma'am, but why don't you go ahead and send that to me so
Thank
I can
you.
Look at it.
I appreciate it. And as I said, have a good meeting in February. I'll be on a cruise.
All right. Is there anyone else? You're closer. Why don't you? Then you.
Hi, and thank you. I'm Alicia Lockwood. I reside at 316 Lapwing. And the last meeting, there were two issues in review that concerned me. As a single female living alone in a townhouse that I own, fee simple, including my land and my exterior, I noticed on the planning committee's suggestions or point in time that two things, it was restricted to residential zoning and also to no multifamily. My community, for one reason or another, was originally zoned as a planned community. It has nothing and is in no way any different than any other purely residential townhome community. So I wanted to point that out, that that may be something you need to look at. And also that it is a townhome, and as we learned earlier, multifamily was changed at some point in time to be a townhome. I think that those two issues could affect myself as a single person dependent on this revenue for my income and many other women like myself who are also living on their retired incomes. And I would hope that the town use all fair and reasonable assumptions in considering those things. And if any changes are going to come about, that you would at least consider grandfathering. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir. If you would step up the microphone and give us your name, address, in a couple minutes.
Thomas Donaldson, 1649 Lauda Drive, Mount Pleasant. I wanted to express my opposition to the committee prohibiting short-term rentals in residential townhouse districts and multifamily districts. And I've heard a lot of kind of ethereal talk about short-term rentals of different issues being raised, so I just wanted to kind of give my experience so that you have a face to put to the issue. So my wife and I live in Wando Lakes, and last summer we bought a townhouse in Hunter's Run, which is just around the corner, as an investment property. Our house in Wando Lakes is about 100 yards from our townhouse, so once a week we walk the dog, grab a laundry basket of sheets and towels, walk down to the townhouse, scrub toilets, sweep floors, and prepare it for the next guest. So I want you to understand that we are not millionaire, out-of-town investors looking to cash in on a booming vacation spot. We're local residents, born and raised here with deep roots in Mount Pleasant, just trying to make a few extra bucks. I understand that you don't want some big real estate investment conglomerate from New York City or Atlanta coming in and buying an entire townhouse building and operating short-term rentals from 1,000 miles away. I don't think anyone in our town wants that. But I would caution you to be careful with how you impose regulations, because if you put in restrictions to prevent short-term rentals in residential townhouse districts and multifamily units across the entire town, you're going to sweep folks like my wife and I up in that net, dozens of hardworking citizens across the town that are seriously going to be facing some serious financial hardships and tough decisions. So none of that's to say that we're not willing to abide by fair and reasonable regulations, but there's no reason to impose a one-size-fits-all regulation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone? Yes, Sally. Give us your name and address, please.
Hi, my name is Kenny Kraft, 204 Spooner Lane, Mount Pleasant. I also wanted to speak in favor of reasonable short-term rental rules, but while allowing it and maintaining it. A few different points I've made once before, but just some different take on it based on some discussions in the last couple of months. The affordable housing question, I think, to me, my take on the short-term rental issues, somewhat of the flip side of it, in my opinion, with the high cost of living today and the cost of living in Charleston and Mount Pleasant, is the ability to rent an extra bedroom out is actually a way of achieving affordable housing in an area where things are so expensive. So to me, it actually could allow somebody to stay in their home, and there's a lot of good examples of, retirement communities or, old people that no longer have their income or retirement that can rent out a room to kind of help them be able to stay in their house and actually stay in their neighborhood. So to me, I think that's an important point that gets misconstrued when you think of it from the other angle. One thing that has been brought up before, I'm an architect. There's been this discussion about, the residential versus commercial. Like, is it a business? Should it be treated like a business? Should it be, more restrictions, more fire alarms or everything? But I wanted to, and I haven't been part of the, I haven't heard the discussions about the townhouses, but as an architect, there's the International Residential Code and the International Building Code for commercial. Residential applies to single-family residential duplexes, and that single-family residential also applies to townhouses. And a townhouse has a fire-rated party wall that separates it between another townhouse, so it's really just a single-family residence. It's not a multifamily house. It's purely a single-family house, treated by that way in the building code and not in the international residential code as just a house that somebody lives in. So in my opinion, there's no difference between a townhouse and a single family house. And not in my opinion, but in the opinion of the building department, that's actually the case. It's only when you get to have above two units, or three units or four units or, 50 units, that it becomes a building code issue. And appropriate controls, I think, it's been mentioned before, this noise-aware product is, I think, a really good idea to work with the potential concern of the party house or the noisy house. I think that there's good technologies out there that are solutions, I think, that are better solutions than, outlawing. And even if there's an infraction and then, maybe a first course of action is to have them do noise-aware instead of just saying, no, you can't do it anymore.
Yes, sir, if you could wrap up.
Please. Wrap it up. To me, I guess to wrap it up, ultimately I think it's a win-win situation for the town, for the residents to be able to have source of income, tax revenue, by doing it kind of legally and you know, with the right licenses and everything. And one tiny last point, I think the statistics show that there's such a small percentage that's actually out there doing this that I think the impact is way exaggerated from what a lot of people get roiled up about. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you, Patrick. Sally, you be next.
I'm sorry. I feel
No.
Would you please?
Go ahead. All right. You've heard much to be a week old.
Sally always likes to be last and finish.
All right. Fine. Patrick Arnold, 25 Beverly Road, serve as the executive officer for the Charleston Home Builders Association. Prior to that, I spent a lot of time working, helping other cities craft ordinances for short-term rentals. So in my former life, I got to know a lot of this. I didn't get a chance to see if staff had a chance to look at the declustering ordinance you guys asked us to provide back to y'all. We sent it over to them. I hope that was beneficial for you all. It's in? Beautiful. Thank you. Also want to talk about the affordability issue. I think he's right. If you do the numbers, and we did this because we didn't want to be at the realtors promoting something that was negatively impacting housing affordability, because, well, that's our number one issue, we think, is destabilizing the market. So we looked at it, and from our research, it showed that not enough short-term rental units were actually on the market to artificially raise the price of homes. You can definitely get more value out of your homes, but it doesn't seem like it's hit that threshold of, say, 4 or 5% of homes being used as short-term rental, where it starts taking things offline and raising prices. So we say that as long as it's not a problem where it's going into, say, you know, 7-8% of homes are being used just for this purpose, it's really not moving it. There's much larger forces in the market that are causing the housing affordability crisis, which is limited availability of land. It's really hard to get subcontractors and folks involved. The process of building's a lot longer. We have a whole lot more things that cause the inflation of the affordability rather than the short-term rental, especially in Mount Pleasant when you see the – y'all are pretty low in terms of most cities that have a percentage of who uses it. Second, it also does help people, since y'all do have very expensive median home prices, some people to keep their homes. I implore you to watch. Last night there was an interview with Rashonda Jones on Live 5 News, where she explains how she and her family inherited a home and they couldn't afford to keep it unless they used it for short-term rentals. So it's actually allowing her the ability to keep her home, although since it's a family property, it's deemed 6%. So it's very important that when doing these ordinances, you have some form of a pathway legally for 6% homeowners as well to be in the fold, because while you may think that it's all investment properties that people are doing 6%, sometimes it is a family's property because somebody doesn't own that home, but a family member lives in it. In order for them to keep it, they have to do this. So there's two sides to that coin that you might hurt the local community who's been here for generations. That's all I have. If you have any other questions, I just wanted to thank you all so much for doing such a thorough job researching all the other municipalities' ordinance and coordinating with the county, because they have been very helpful in working to craft something that's reasonable. So thank you.
Sally?
I'm trying to take all of these various issues into my head without taking notes. I'm Sarah Jacob, otherwise known as Sally. I live at 1152 Village Creek Lane, Apartment 1, Mount Pleasant. And my issue is affordability and also the question of townhomes. Not townhomes, multifamily dwellings, because I live in a condo complex. We recently found that 16 of our 132 units are rented short-term. That's just one little thing. Those units could be rented long-term, and many of them were rented long-term before we began to have short-term rentals. We would like to have teachers, firefighters, and so forth live in multifamily dwellings because they can't afford to buy a home. Let's face it. So you're taking went with short-term rentals have definitely taken long-term rental affordable places off the market for us. I do think that if somebody wants to rent a bedroom in their home, we already have a bed and breakfast arrangement and all of that. So one bedroom in my condo complex rented out for somebody. The problem with it, though, is it takes parking spaces away from those who want to live there long term. So I guess all I'm trying to tell you is please do not allow short-term rentals in multifamily areas for a variety of reasons. I could tell you some horror stories. But in addition to that, if you do, and I really appreciate GM's willingness to, and I hope the rest of you, to contribute some of the revenue stream from business licensing to affordable housing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sal. Is there anyone else? Okay. You're on.
Thank you. I'm just going to go over some of the changes that came out of last month's committee meeting. So to get to the issue of townhouses and multifamily units, what we heard from this committee was that while originally we heard that it should be prohibited in multifamily districts, what came out of last month's meeting was that any townhouse or multifamily unit should be owner-occupied. And so we added some draft language in, basically allowing still the short-term rental of a room of out of a townhouse or a multifamily unit, but it must be owner-occupied. And so that language was added to the prohibitions. Next, we heard the original draft had language that said the owner would sign an affidavit saying that the structure met all of the safety requirements for fire and building. What came out of last month's meeting was that there needed to be something more definitive where the actual town staff went in and conducted an inspection. And so we have added some language that it would require an annual safety inspection. And our building inspections department is working with our fire department to come up with that language. But we did add that provision in that there would be an annual safety inspection rather than just that affidavit that we had originally talked about in the first draft. To get to the 20% to go to the new 501c3 nonprofit Housing for All, we sent that over to our legal department. I know that they're working with our finance department on, you know, that would just be some language that is, would be written into the ordinance, presumably. So they're looking at that right now. And we don't have any answers back on that, but that's certainly something that we got out of last committee meeting and work is under consideration.
I think GM has a question, please.
Yeah, I have a question on that specific thing. I mean, currently the current 501c3 is Housing for All Mount Pleasant, but in the future there could be other things that the town is working on for affordable housing. So I don't know that the language needs to be so specific
right.
that it goes specifically to a specific 501c3. I think that it could be more generic, that it's dedicated towards supporting affordable housing in the town of Mount Pleasant,
right.
just in case things change in the future.
Okay.
The wording on that that says the fee collected, is that all fees collected? Or just the taxes? Is this accommodations tax fees also?
It's the annual fee.
There would be an application fee for the short-term rental. Yeah, we've discussed perhaps maybe $500 would be the fee. And that because one of the concerns that came out of the committee meetings were that any program that's implemented would be sustainable. And so we've been working with finance and the business department. And so we're thinking a $500 fee.
I think I just think it would be good to then put 20% of the application fee, just so it doesn't look like all fees collected for this.
This isn't the language. That's just my bullet point. Okay. We haven't crafted that
okay.
provision to go in the ordinance.
All right.
That's just kind of the bullet point of what came out of last. But you're correct. It would be the application fee.
Okay.
Yeah. ADUs, last committee meeting, it came out that if there is an ADU, that the owner live in either the ADU or the principal dwelling, that language needs to be tweaked in our our existing zoning code under our accessory uses, and so that's something that we're working on separately. There was a concern of parking. We do have parking requirements now, both for ADUs and for our bed and breakfast ordinance, but we did add in some language that there would be required at least one additional off-street parking for every bedroom rented on a short-term basis, and that was pretty comparable to some of the other municipalities and how their parking standards were. And then probably the more important part that came out of the last committee meeting was, as Patrick mentioned, was the clustering ordinance. So first there was the mention of having just an overall cap, and then there was the concern that if you just implemented that cap that there would be a concentration of these in perhaps Old Mount Pleasant or certain neighborhoods. And so Patrick had sent over a couple of examples, and so I'll just run through those real quick. The first one was Durango, Colorado, and this one probably seems to be the more straightforward. It basically limits the number of short-term rentals along a street segment, and so just to kind of give you an example, and I just took an area of Mount Pleasant. So, and I don't think I have a pointer, but I'll try to explain it. So in other words, if you have a short-term rental that's on along a street segment. Oh, thank you. So that's not working.
Can you use this?
Oh, can I?
Yeah.
Oh, just the mouse. Oh, great. Okay. So basically how the Durango, Colorado ordinance is, you can have one short-term rental along a street segment. So say, for instance, there's an application provided to the town, and they're given a permit to have a short-term rental. So it would run between these two street segments. So this would be the only one allowed along this street segment. You couldn't have one across the street along that same street segment. You could have one over here between along that street segment between those two intersecting streets. And then how it works on a corner lot, if we understood this correctly, was if there was a short-term rental issued on a corner lot, the street segments covered would be, there would be no other short-term rentals permitted along that street and along that street to the closest intersecting street. So that kind of gives you an idea of how the clustering works for the Durango, Colorado. And just something to kind of throw out for you to think about is Durango has a population of about 19,000, total square area 6.8 square miles. So they have a little bit smaller area that they're working with their declustering ordinance, but I thought it might be good to throw those numbers out so you can compare that to us, with, you know, 80,000 population with 45 square miles. So, but that's how that works in Durango, Colorado. I'm sorry, you had a question.
I guess my question was, I like the idea and the spirit of the rule, but how does the person with the star, I mean, they won the lottery to be able to be that. How can the neighbor that wants to do it get in, or are they just out?
They don't, unless that goes away. All right.
First come, first serve.
That's right.
Does that convey with the property?
I'm sorry?
Does that right convey with the property?
It's not transferable. A new owner would have to come in. So that's the first example. That, from our perspective, seemed to be a little more straightforward. Tuscaloosa, Alabama has one where they limit by a percent cap, 10% cap, and that's just limited to their historic districts. And then in this particular historic district, the Druid City district, not only does it have a 10% cap, but it also has a 1 along each block. So it kind of doubles up. And then a couple of other that we talked about, just cap ordinances. I know I mentioned it when I provided the comparison to other municipalities, but Beaufort, they do a 6% in their residential zones. And then Savannah, Georgia, they actually limit the non-owner-occupied short-term rentals to, it's a 20% cap on the wards. So there's approximately, I think, 22 squares or wards. So they limit by a percentage as well. So that's kind of your example of a declustering ordinance. There really wasn't a whole lot out there. If it wasn't for Patrick providing the Durango example, there's not a lot of examples out there. And so I think from our perspective, it seemed to be a little more straightforward doing it along the street segment. When you start looking at percentages, you've got to maybe perhaps have defined neighborhoods. And so, you know, some areas of our town, we may not have a defined neighborhood. So anyway, I'm happy to answer any questions.
So if we were to take the areas of the town, Mount Pleasant, that have HOAs that don't allow this,
mm-hmm.
How big an area, you may not know this, how big an area do we actually have where short-term rentals like this can actually exist? I would think it'd be much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Than,
yeah.
It may be around the size of Durango.
Well, it seems like that would work really well when you have a grid system as well. And a lot of our town is not built on a grid system. So you've got winding roads that kind of go back in cul-de-sacs and dead ends. And so I can see the value of something like that in a place like Old Mount Pleasant. We've got, you know, a grid system and it's more dense. I'm not sure that would be particularly useful in the places you're talking about, which have larger subdivisions with HOAs. And so maybe we need to have some sort of distinction where we're talking about.
Yeah, we may very well.
I like the concept of the street segment system, but I think there should also be a percentage cap as well, because I mean, some of these percentages, 20% of the parcels, that seems like an enormous changing of the character of it. And Mount Pleasant is, at its heart, a residential community. So I think a combination, and we're, I mean, it is a very low percentage right now, below 1%, but I think that we need to, that's the reason why we're addressing this now, because before it becomes a large problem for our town. So I think I like the concept of the street segment. That would take care of sort of the problem of five houses on Atlantic in old Mount Pleasant. But I think we should also institute a cap of 1% so that we maintain the character of our town for its residents and maintain quality of life for our residents.
I was just wondering, like the 1%, 1% per neighborhood, 1% per entire town?
1% for the town's total residential unit number.
1% of the entire population or 1% of those that can have these? Because there's a lot of, I think an awful lot of the town are going to be exempt from this right off the bat because their homeowners associations aren't going to allow it. But I don't know.
Yeah, that would. And we've had.
We've had in previous meetings areas, maps of where it was. This would be more likely to exist than before, and I think, you know, like Dunes West, Park West, a lot of those were taken out because the HOA didn't allow them, which really reduces it to, you know, some of the older parts of Mount Pleasant. And, you know, we may have to work on that percentage.
Using our numbers, if there are approximately 40,000 total dwelling units in town, then that 1% would be 400. And then so you'd have 400 across an entire town or 400 across half the town, in effect, doubles the density, if you will, if there are areas that aren't allowed to have them. So coming up with the percentage and or what it is applicable to, just, you know, we need to be thinking through the ramifications of what that means. But we can provide additional data about area and units and availability or the potential for having them as we work on something. As you consider such numbers, then we could have the maps and the information that you could use to reference.
Yeah, I would like to see a map that has blocked out all of the HOAs that limit and restrict. You know, I know that's a massive task. I mean, it'd be easier just to say 1% of 40,000 total dwelling units, but I think that concern about it concentrating in an area maybe makes it worthwhile to consider, you know, if we can look at the larger developments in town and look at and see which ones are sort of taken out of the mix.
Which brings another question. Do we need to coordinate with the HOAs
who say, let's say an HOA does not allow this, but then they find that there are short-term rentals going on within those areas. Is that, since this is our ordinance, would we enforce that, or does the HOA enforce that?
HOA.
HOA, okay. Okie dokie. Anything else?
Just a clarification on that question. So if we find, if this goes forward and we find that one of the subdivisions has people operating short-term rentals, and we've got licensing and business licensing and that sort of thing, we don't, as a town, then go in, bring them into compliance, or?
They wouldn't receive a permit from us.
Well, but they're still operating, though, so who would be responsible for enforcing that? What? I heard you say the HOA, but if we have a town ordinance that says you can't operate an STR without business license, do we not then have the town enforcement involved?
We currently have an affidavit that says is or is not restricted by your covenants and restrictions. And so presumably they would say, you know, if it's Park West or Dunes West, it's not allowed. And so they would not be able to get a permit. But if they continue to operate and they were violating the town's ordinance by operating, I think it would be twofold. I think an HOA could come at them from their perspective. But if they're operating a short-term rental and they haven't received a permit because it's against their covenants and restrictions, and we wouldn't issue the permit, I think that that's a code enforcement issue as well.
That's also to clarify. I just want to make sure we weren't leaving up to the HOA to decide how to enforce that if they're in violation of a town ordinance.
Is there a fine structure?
I'm sorry?
Is there a fine structure for people operating in violation, like a daily fine of $100 a day or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's written in. It would civil. We've got other language written in, and it refers to our other town code for penalties.
Okay.
So, yeah. And we've also written in the draft ordinance that it would even be a violation to advertise that you have a short-term rental if you don't have a permit. So.
Okay. Well, I think as we dig down through the whole thing with someone who's running an illegal short-term rental in an HOA property, if they're in violation of our ordinances, even though they're not allowed by the HOA, I think that we'll have to double-check with legal folks, but I think it's going to fall to us because they're violating a town ordinance by not coming to get a permit. So. Okay, just something to think about.
Do we have staff question? We've got scores of HOAs. Do we even have access to their covenants and
some
restrictions?
Some of that information, I think, we know which some of them.
I was worried about
probably
it.
Probably the newer ones. I'm not sure as you start to go back in time.
I think it's going to be tough for us, Ms. Whitley, to produce that information you were looking for.
Okay. Yeah, no, I totally understand that, and I'm okay, I guess, with the 1% cap for the total number for ease of, because I still think there's still enough square mileage of land that it'll be distributed, mm-hmm. especially if we implement the road segment thing.
Okay. All right. Anything else? No.
Just for clarification, so. According to the draft that we have now, townhomes would only be allowed short-term rentals if they're owner-occupied. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else?
We'll see you next month with, I think we're at a point where we've covered probably most of the major aspects of an ordinance, so we can continue to pull it together and then be able to present to you more details on how these pieces would work.
Okay.
Do we want to address the issue of the grandfathering in provision for people already operating legal short-term rentals that have basically created their lives in reliance upon this?
There's two different things going on. So right now we have a process for a bed and breakfast. And that process is to go through the Board of Zoning Appeals. And so when you mention 4 or 5 along Atlantic Street, those are bed and breakfasts in the traditional sense that they either rent out a room on a short-term basis or an ADU, and they have went through the Board of Zoning Appeals and received approval. So those are legitimately operating an approved bed and breakfast. Short-term rentals that did not go through the bed and breakfast process, to grandfather those in, there's no way to track those right now because we don't permit them. They're not prohibited or anything, so they're just operating. So to grandfather those in would be very difficult. We don't, you know, other than the folks that stand up and tell us their address. But the bed and breakfast that went through the Board of Zoning Appeals, I do believe there should be a grandfathering in for those. They went through the Board of Zoning Appeals, and they're operating through the proper process. So it's kind of two different things going on,
okay.
Just to clarify.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to ask on your comments, Michelle. So there is no mechanism in place now for us to know who's legally operating STR?
They're all legal. We don't prohibit them right now.
Well, I mean, in terms of if this were talking about the grandfathering, and if we've got somebody who's operating those, is there a mechanism to know who's doing that according to?
We have like six approved bed and breakfasts. We have a spreadsheet, and they've went through the Board of Zoning Appeals process. There's a legitimate bed and breakfast where the owner lives on site and operates a bed and breakfast. I think we have maybe six, seven, eight of those that went through the Board of Zoning Appeals. Everything else is a short-term rental.
They're just operating out there.
And right, around. And they're allowed to right now.
Yes.
So.
Finish our discussion here.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, perhaps we could also implement the same sort of segmenting issue in something like a townhome, a multifamily. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. Or
if I don't know where this would fit in, but if a person in a group of townhomes, if person lives in the building, let's say there's a building, six townhomes, and that person acquires another townhome next door or whatever, and they're supposed to live in the same building, does that, in what y'all have looked at, does that qualify?
I don't know if we've seen anything that got that specific. I mean, when you talk about it, is that dwelling unit, if you're going to be, if you occupy the dwelling unit, which you then rent a room or multiple rooms,
mm-hmm.
owning two, those are two separate properties, and so allowing that to happen is a different twist on.
Got it. Okay, I got it.
We had talked about creating like an open period of application where we would accept kind of everyone who's kind of existing in this currently legal framework to apply and essentially secure their spot and then close that window and then have it on a forward-looking basis, and it would not be transferable if the properties changed hands, if they didn't pay their annual fee, it's use it or lose it, and then moving forward from that basis, because that would cover everyone who's currently doing this kind of in the wild without the ordinance in place and allow them to maintain their livelihoods, but then it would on an ongoing basis in the future restrict and have the segmenting or have the cap.
So it'd be like creating an amnesty period?
Yes, almost like creating an amnesty period, so that those who have basically structured their lives so that their livelihood is based upon this business model, we're not taking away their livelihood.
That'd be part of launch and implementation. That would be a component that could be considered.
It's the same conversation we had before about the permit allocation. I mean, we've got our rules that basically allow people to invest and create a situation in their lives for revenue or income or whatever. And then I think the issue of fairness is, Tom, as you mentioned earlier, is do we cut those people off at the knee and say, well, new sheriff in town, game's changed, or is there a way for us to allow them to continue, but in the future have some control over that? And whatever we can do around that, I think, is appropriate. And I'd like to see that because there are people, you know, based on the the rules that we had in place, you know, have made some significant investments with property and upgrades, and I just think it's fair for us to take those into account.
Just help me, probably questions for you three, but I'm having a hard time understanding the difference between a townhome with a firewall that has four units or maybe a duplex that has two units and is allowed, and the townhouse not being allowed unless you live there. I'm trying to figure out what the difference in that is. Well, I can understand parking maybe, but...
Well, I think Jeff just explained that the test is it's a dwelling unit.
Okay.
And even a duplex is two separate dwelling units.
Yes.
Correct. And a townhouse...
Parcel line, yeah.
Yeah, maybe four,
yeah.
Five, but they're each considered separate. So if you live in one, like one side of a duplex,
right,
you're not living in the dwelling unit that you rent
right
out.
Right. Okay. But they're not allowed.
That's a policy choice as the community. I mean, that's a policy choice you would make. Do you treat townhome or duplex residential development? It's effectively a type of single family. It's attached versus right detached. And it's the choice, the policy choice you make, and we can write the ordinance.
Sure.
We've
decided that they're out.
But as suggested through prior committee discussion.
Right.
That you would have to live in the townhome or the multifamily apartment or condo in order to be able to rent out. And there it wouldn't be the whole unit then. It would only be a bedroom
or something.
And then you have to become a bed and breakfast. Okay.
We'll keep at it.
Got that? Okay.
Thank you for doing all that. I know it's a lot.
We're used to it. It's good stuff.
The last item
that we had for you here was just an update, and Ms. Boyles has been providing council as well as planning commission updates and reports along the way. Just wanted to give you a feel and the community a feel for where we are. The plan forum has recommended the draft plan to move on to the planning commission. So we will start next week with work sessions and discussion meetings with the Planning Commission. They said they didn't want to drag it out and talk about it forever. So they want some very intense, you know, loaded discussions and work through it as quickly as they can. At the end of January, our idea is that in conjunction with their January meeting, we would let them host a town hall like we've had in the past for the comprehensive plan, and then they get that direct input from the public about where the draft stands and where it should go. And then in February they would be in a they would continue in at the end of January, and then into February they'd be in a position to take the benefit of the public input they've heard and make any adjustments, suggested changes to council, and potentially be in a position by the end of their meeting in February to be able to give you all a recommendation, and we'd move the adoption process to town council. So we just wanted to give you a feel for where we are.
Okay. Does it go straight to town council without coming to this committee?
It would probably come to, it depends. One of the things you have to decide is, like you just did,
so it would be better if it went to
council,
full council
presentation.
Yeah. Probably the best way, like you just did with the other topic. Let the whole council get it rather than...
Yeah, either way is fine. I was just curious.
Yeah. And that's all we have from the planning side of things.
Okay. So number seven came from you, Bob.
It did.
So I chimed in at the end, but you can go ahead.
All right. Well, this is... an issue that arose from the Foxmoor community in Park West. They're having some issues there with very, very heavy traffic and some dangerous driving through the neighborhood. After talking with staff and talking with members of the community, it was discussed that perhaps a temporary closure of the connection between the Center Park neighborhood, which is currently under construction, and the Foxmoor neighborhood would be appropriate until such time as the Park West widening is completed and that road becomes functional again during peak hours. I did give you all a little bit of a background on this last council meeting, but I'm happy to do it again if you need that. And I want to recognize Mr. Bustos did comment on this at the town council meeting, and really raised the issue about other parts of town that have these same concerns and wanting to treat neighborhoods fairly. And I think that's an appropriate comment. And I think every time we have problems like this, those neighborhoods deserve to have their issues looked at very closely and look at possible solutions. But I want to focus on this one today in particular, because there's some circumstances here that are maybe different from other parts of town that I think support the idea of a temporary closure. Now, Brad, you have a slide up there. Did you have something? You got some background? So what we're talking about here is John Bartram Place is the road that toward the top of the screen there goes from the Center Park neighborhood under construction at the left, and it winds all the way down to the front of the neighborhood and then exits out on Park West Boulevard and two entrances. The problem is that over the years, town council really delayed doing anything with Park West Boulevard, the increasing traffic there, and really created a situation where the road is not functional in the mornings and other peak hours. So what happens is a lot of the Park West traffic will come down into that roundabout at the top left, and rather than sit in traffic on Park West Boulevard, they will go forward through the Center Park neighborhood, down John Bartram Place, and try to exit Park West Boulevard through that neighborhood. That's created a tremendous amount of traffic, really causing some problems in the neighborhood. So some of the circumstances here that are a little bit different is, number one, council sort of created this problem by waiting 20 years to fix it. But we're really suggesting here a temporary closure of that connection until such time as Park West Boulevard is four-laned, which will provide relief and will take away the incentive to cut through the neighborhood. There's also a situation here in the Center Park neighborhood, which is under construction, is that there's a lot of contractor parking on the side of the road. And so we're basically encouraging people to come through that neighborhood and create a very dangerous situation trying to weave back and forth between contractors, trucks, and other traffic to come down through that neighborhood. So we really should not be encouraging all that traffic to go through there. But I understand why they do. It's certainly a little bit quicker than it is sitting in traffic on Park West Boulevard. So what the neighborhood would like to see is a physical barrier on that connection to keep that traffic from going through the neighborhood until such time as Park West Boulevard is complete, at which time the connection would then reopen and we'd have a better traffic flow. And I'm happy to answer any questions around that. Yeah. Do you have any?
Yeah. Bob, I have a couple questions. What kind of barrier are we talking about?
I'd leave that to staff to sort of decide what the best thing, but something physically, because I think the initial request was for signage, but signage is just not going to stop people from going through there. So some sort of physical barrier that prevents traffic from moving from neighborhood to neighborhood would be my suggestion.
And where do you see that barrier?
Right there between where you see the undeveloped neighborhood and where it turns white, the street turns white.
Okay. Now, what about emergency vehicles? Because I can foresee a police vehicle or something coming from this side. Now, he has to go all the way to the traffic circle, come down, come back around, but it's just a short leg into it.
There's actually three entrances to Foxmore. There is, I forget the name of that one that connects from John Bartram over to Park West Boulevard, and then there's two entrances along Park West Boulevard on the right side. So there's actually three entrances to the neighborhood that could be, and actually there's four when you consider Churchill Park is connected as well. So it's probably one of the best connected neighborhoods in Park West, having four ways to get in.
Well, but won't people who want to go through there just look for one of those entrances?
No, because most of the traffic in Park West comes down from Gray Marsh into that traffic circle. And mm-hmm. So they can either take the left on Park West Boulevard or they can go through the Foxmore neighborhood. What they do is they take that John Bartram Place to avoid the traffic backups on Park West Boulevard.
And the people who live next to the barrier, now who had a short run to get out will have to go the other way further. Is everyone, you think, pretty much in agreement with this? Or?
Pretty much. That's the way it's been before this neighborhood was constructed. Mm-hmm. So they're very used to this traffic pattern. And it's only, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile down to that first road, if that. So it's...
Okay. All right. Yes, ma'am.
Will that just create a new bottleneck or through that, I can't read it,
Patmore.
Yeah, through that, would that, and then people just come down through there and cut through John Barton? You know, I'm just worried that we're trading one problem for another.
The reason that going into that into Center Park neighborhood is so attractive for people coming from the north and the neighborhoods to the north is because they come off the traffic circle and avoid Park West Boulevard altogether. Once you get on Park West Boulevard, it backs up. So you'd have to wait in traffic to get down to Patmore anyway, as opposed to going through Center Park and being able to go straight down. So we really created a kind of a quicker way for folks to get through there, unfortunately, through this neighborhood, because Park West Boulevard isn't moving very quickly in the morning. So you could do that, but you'd still be sitting in traffic to get to Patmore. So.
I mean, what does the transportation department think of that potential for then just switching to Patmore, or do you think that this will solve the problem? Because then it'll solve the problem for that one segment of road, but not for the rest of the segment of John Bartram and Thomas Barksdale. Do you think this will solve the problem, I guess, is my question.
I don't know if it's absolute. I can't really answer that until we actually close. But there could be a solution for that particular concern about moving it to Patmore. I think it'd need to have some discussions with the neighborhood about a turn restriction in the morning for a certain period of time that you'd probably have to periodically enforce. But if that turns out to be the case, that's an option. Certainly, it's going to alleviate a lot of the just the ease at which you can come right out of the circle and into the cut-through route. So, to be honest with you, I don't know how much you'll gain because people have to sit on the exits of Foxmoor and Churchill to get out in the morning. So I don't even know if they're gaining that much. They, in their minds, they probably are.
Tom, you have
any? I'm looking at Google Earth and the above it, where the people are coming from to the circle, and it's the area to the north of that right there only, because you're separated by marsh and some places like that. So my thought as I just sit here, and I don't know anything about traffic or any of this stuff, but they should name this after my wife, because she will like try to find the shortest absolute route through anything. But I don't know at the end of the day, two things concern me. One, I'm not so sure it's going to make a big difference. But two, wow, this isn't the only place in this town that's got this problem. I mean, I can think of, as I drive around, wouldn't it be neat to do this or do that? So I, for me, I feel like it's absolutely frustrating the people who live on that road to see the cars go by in the morning, in the afternoon. I get that. But I don't know if it's really going to help the situation too much. It might make them think that it's a little bit better. And then the second thing is I'm very concerned that this would open up a lot of doors to other neighborhoods trying to get that 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock window. I live off of Long Point Road. I can't get out in the morning. I have to make a right when I'm going definitely to the left. But you know what? I like Mount Pleasant. I live here. I deal with it. And it's what it is. So I don't know. I think that's where I stand.
Okay. Well, I would just say also that the difference here is that Long Point is a collector road. It collects from neighborhoods. John Bartram is not a collector road. It's a neighborhood road.
Yeah.
And it worked just fine until this connection was opened up and that construction started. So
when will construction be done? Do we?
16 to 20.
16. Months. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the solution here is in place. The town's already approved it. Construction, you know, will occur this year. So this is not a permanent closure. This is an attempt to try to mitigate a situation sort of created by the town, which was taking a quiet neighborhood, and now people can't back up out of their driveways in the morning because of the traffic that comes down that way. And again, it's not going to totally solve the problem, but it is a way for them to control the amount of traffic that comes down there. So this was a request from the neighborhood. It's been a real issue for them. The town's heard a lot about it. This is a kind of a low-tech, inexpensive way for us to address this issue. So I would just like to put a motion in place here that that we put a temporary barrier between the Foxmoor and Center Park neighborhoods.
Okay, I think that fails for lack of a second. Let me continue a little discussion about that and offer maybe something else. I remember from years ago when Charleston National, after Wando opened, that all the high school students were cutting through Rifle Range Road into the back of Charleston National, and then coming up to Highway 17 and turning to Wando, and that's where we wound up with the speed cushions,
yes,
the cushions. But I also remember we got our hands slapped because someone stopped a high school student on their way to Wando. He was turned around and sent back, and I think there was a parent who took exception to that. I don't know if you remember that or not, Chief, but ultimately it wound up, and the best we could do was put the speed cushions in. And then we have the Groves, Cooper States, and all those which are similar because it's cut through traffic. And I really do believe what we do for one, we need to do for the other. The only thing I could possibly see that might work on this is, can you move that pointer down into that dirt area? Nope, the other way. Yeah, right there to the Y, where it makes a Y. Nope, the other way.
Oh, right here. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right there. Is to ban, you say part of it is construction traffic?
Well, there's a lot of parking along the sides of the road that create a dangerous sort of weaving in and out and can't see around the corner and that kind of situation.
And I just asked this as a question, can we prohibit construction traffic from going in there and thereby creating some of this blockage?
Those houses are all under construction. That neighborhood's under construction, so the roads, the infrastructure, the
yeah. Well, I mean,
houses.
if there was a something there, you know, that would just make that neighborhood, until it's built out, they wouldn't contribute construction traffic the other way.
Construction traffic isn't what's creating the problem. It's the problem with the construction traffic is that it's parked on the side of the road. And so you've got trucks, cars are coming in there having to go like this around things parked on the side of the road. And it's also around the curb there. So you've got cars coming out of the neighborhood who can't see around the trucks that are parked along the side of the road. It's just a safety issue there, really.
Yeah.
You know, we shouldn't be encouraging traffic to take that route in the morning.
Yeah. Mr. Pagliarini, these are all public roads, correct? Okay. From the legal standpoint, where we stand.
So I think from an emergency standpoint, we talked about this, you know, with our staff. I think if there's an emergency standpoint, or really not an emergency, but a reasonable basis for closure, such as safety, health, and welfare, just our roadway systems, as long as we are providing access to the roadway system. So we don't have a problem necessarily, at least with what is proposed.
Just by way of history, this connection wasn't even in place a year and a half ago, I don't think. So this is a new connection. Prior to that, the situation was people came off the roundabout, used Park West Boulevard, and went their way.
Yes, ma'am.
And your proposal is to leave that in place even when that neighborhood is fully developed in 16 to 20 months until Park West Boulevard is fully widened.
Mayor, my proposal would be that barrier stays there until the construction on Park West Boulevard is done. Then the barrier comes out and that connection is open.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I guess I would just like to understand or maybe think about a little bit more before we make a decision. I mean, if this comes back to us in a month or so, just would it truly solve the problem? Because I don't know that it would, given that there's just another entrance, just a few hundred feet down the road with Patmore, where they'll just cut in through there. Because I think, you know, people will do that. And if you're saying signage isn't going to solve the problem, then putting signage on Patmore isn't going to solve the problem, because people will still turn it. And if it's just an enforcement issue, but maybe putting a signage and having people. And having that enforced, will that solve the problem? I just don't know that blocking off the road is going to be the optimal solution. And I echo Tom's concern that this is going to open the floodgates of other neighborhoods who are going to say, well, what about us? What about?
Well, I think with that logic, then, neighborhoods that do have a valid reason, we're pretty much saying we don't want to hear from them either. I think what this suggestion does is says, we will look at each individual situation on its own merits, and where it's appropriate to take action, we will, and when it's not appropriate, we won't. But by to say we're not going to do anything here because it's unfair to other neighborhoods, basically what we're saying is we're going to ignore all the concerns out there across the board, and I don't think that's very responsive government.
But Bob, I believe it's about how much time are you saving to get from point A to point B. That's what the real issue is. So, as it relates to other neighborhoods, that's what we're doing. All I'm saying is if you don't cut through there, you have to leave 2 minutes earlier or 3 minutes earlier.
Yeah, that's
you don't think it's that much? You think it's more than that?
I would suggest that anyone here who's interested is to get on Park West Boulevard in the morning and try to go from those northern neighborhoods down to the schools or 17, and then you'll experience what happens. Because,
But it's like that all the way down, isn't it? It's not just right here.
No, it clears up once it gets to four lanes.
Yeah, right.
And so that's what we're fixing on Park West Boulevard. But until now, what you're basically saying is, well, we're going to, rather than have them sit on Park West Boulevard, we'll divert the traffic, allow the traffic to be diverted through this neighborhood. And I just think that's patently unfair. It's a situation created by the town, honestly. And now we're asking them to bear the brunt of that for another 18 months.
Go ahead, Gio.
Would it be appropriate to suggest that this go to the Transportation Committee, that they consider this in more deeply?
Well, that was the original plan this month, but that would have been the only item for them. What I'm inclined to do probably is, and this is no offense to the committee, but since none of you have the experience of this area with traffic, and some of our other council members do, I may just bring the suggestion and motion up at full council to give everyone a chance to... Mm-hmm. So those who are familiar with the situation can also have a say in it. Because I think your concerns are being heard, but if you've not experienced this over the years, you really don't appreciate the traffic patterns that have developed here because of the two-lane road.
I was going to ask a question. I do drive up there every day. Every day. And is there a complaint about high school traffic cutting through? You know, I hear the reference to dangerous drivers, speeding, and all those things. But once the rush is over for the kids going to school, to Wando, and trying to get across Airport Road or Faison Road is bad as well. You know, two things. If it's just a school at start time and finish time, because finish time is terrible too. And with Oceanside Academy, that, and now Costco, you're right. It's bad. But I think it's more during the morning hours for school and the afternoon hours for school. Because sometimes I pull right out of the airport and I'm in traffic.
Well, I'll tell you that if you look at, and Tom did this, if you look at the the Google Maps, the wider Google Maps, what you realize is that the vast majority of homes in Park West are north of that traffic circle. Mm-hmm. And that is the only way out for those folks. So it's not only school traffic, it's people trying to get to work in the morning. It's appointment. I mean, it's all that traffic that comes out of those hundreds of homes that come down to that one central point, which is that traffic circle. Mm-hmm. And from there, the only option before that connection was to sit in traffic for a very long time waiting to get down Park West Boulevard. What people have figured out is that they can save a minute or two by going through that traffic circle, through Foxmoor, to get to the location. And I don't blame them, but we've created a situation where now Decent's neighborhood has to bear the brunt of hundreds of commuters in the morning having to decide how to get to school, Wando, the other schools, to work, the 17. It's an unfortunate situation, but this is a simple temporary solution that would ease that somewhat.
Go ahead, Gia.
Does this neighborhood not qualify for our existing programs, like the speed bump programs?
Well, the issue here is less about dangerous driving. I mean, it's about the volume. It's the sheer volume of traffic that comes down this, and it prevents people from being able to back up out of their driveways or cross streets with kids or kids on bicycles. That's the core issue, is just the volume of cars that come down that road every day. And so this, the barrier would be a way to reduce the volume. And
well, yeah, I think if we're going to do this, we need to do, and not trying to throw a damper on John Bartram, but if we're going to do this, I think we need to take, like, Cooper States, the Groves, and all those, because they have to be addressed, in my mind, equally, because they've been living, those folks have been living with this as well. So, and maybe there's some study that needs to be done. But I know when the engineers, even before Highway 17 was widened, there was a traffic engineer that told us that we didn't have, that traffic should be left alone to find its way around, that if we tried to force people, and in the context of 17, I remember him telling us, if you widen 17, everyone will see Highway 17 as the answer to everything, and everyone will abandon the side roads and the cut-throughs and go to 17, and all you're going to do is, I remember he said, instead of having stacking like this, you're just going to have it like this, but it's not going to solve the problem. Do you remember that, Brad? Maybe? No?
That during JDB, Johnny Dodds? Or?
Yeah, yeah. It's going down. I mean,
you got a better memory.
That's all you're going to do, and because I can foresee if this were blocked today, Bob, and it went on for what, 20 months, 24 months, the minute you went out there to pull that thing down, the people would be howling from everywhere. And they said, no, you've had it here for 20 months. Leave it.
Well,
because the traffic with the addition of those houses would then just be going down there, and there would be more traffic. I mean, this is...
That's why my motion really had the piece in it that said the barrier is only temporary and comes down, because, of course, people are going to want that to stay up. Hey, now we got it. But yeah. But that would be part of the motion to say, no, the expectation is that will not stay up there, because there's no reason to. Once Park West Boulevard is widened to four lanes, the traffic will flow smoothly, and there won't be an advantage to going through the neighborhood. It'll be quicker to stand Park West Boulevard.
Let me get on some record that I don't want to open the Cooper Estates can of worms or all those other things.
Yeah, nor do I, but that's that's what I think will happen. Yes, ma'am.
I mean, if my memory is wrong, but I feel like Cooper Estates has asked to close off that road as well, to close off their road. They have. They've asked to close off their road. So, we can't just willy-nilly sort of start closing off roads in the town and disrupting connectivity. But I mean, I feel like I still could be convinced if I felt like this would actually solve the problem. But I'm not convinced yet that this would solve the problem for the majority of John Bartram Way.
Well, we have
we have, well, you know, it's, 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 we have, well, you know, it's,